WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Silicon Valley is reinventing itself as the new headquarters for the military technological complex, according to journalist Jeffrey Rosen. His article, The Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. He writes about new technologies and database systems that are being developed to identify and track terrorists, how the CIA is funding some of these efforts, and why civil libertarians are concerned. Rosen is an associate professor at George Washington University Law School, legal affairs editor of The New Republic, and author of The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America. Let's start with an overview of the investment the CIA has now in the Silicon Valley.
The CIA has started this very interesting venture capital firm called InQtel, and the Q stands for the character from James Bond. It was the idea of George Tenet, the CIA director, and the idea is to invest about $30 million a year in internet startups and young companies on the theory that technologies that were useful before September 11th for profiling, monitoring, and recording customers on Amazon might now be useful for profiling, monitoring, and recording and identifying potential terrorists. But because it's a regular venture capital firm, the technologies have to be commercially viable, and indeed the companies negotiate the sale of their technologies for national intelligence purposes, but the main idea is to have them useful in the commercial sphere as well.
So who is the head of this new company, InQtel?
He's a very interesting character called Gilman Louie, who was one of the most successful games manufacturers of all times. This is the man whose first big success was Falcon, which is the air simulation game, which was so popular not only with teenage boys, but with the Air Force, that it used it to teach fighter pilots how to fly real jets. But then his big success was a couple of years ago when he imported Tetris from the Soviet Union. And Tetris, of course, was the most popular computer game of all times. It sold 70 to 80 million copies, and he told me that Hillary Clinton loved playing Tetris on the Game Boy, so that was very exciting to him. And Gilman Louie was marketing Hasbro's computer game site a couple of years ago in 1998 when he was approached with a very unusual offer. And George Tenet, the CIA director, asked him to head this interesting new company called InQtel and to go swimming in the valley to try to persuade the internet entrepreneurs to play ball with the CIA.
Why do you think somebody whose specialty is computer games was asked to head up InQtel?
Well, he said very frankly, he said that the CIA actually thought that my computer game background was a valuable asset because I look at the world as one big system, one big game. I actually hadn't seen these things, but he described to me Falcon, which is an extraordinarily complicated and realistic effort to simulate not only gunfights and dogfights, but also geopolitical strategies. There are all sorts of other political and simulation choices to be made. So in this sense, he thought that what the CIA is doing now in the real world is very similar to what he had done as a game developer. He also has a knack for fighter technology himself. He's an amateur fighter pilot, and I think met the CIA recruiter in a dogfight that was sponsored by a computer magazine to see who was the top dog among business executives. So it's the combination of the military background and the idea of seeing the world as one big system that was very appealing to the CIA.
Now, you say that the CIA wants the Silicon Valley to develop technologies that have been used already for identifying, profiling, and tracking potential customers, and to use these technologies to identify and track potential terrorists. Give us a sense of how that might apply, how that might work.
One of the most promising examples is the use of technologies that had been deployed to detect credit card fraud and to use that to create profiles of potential terrorists. So, for example, people who study these things tell you that credit card fraud often fits a consistent pattern. People who steal credit cards will use them at self-service stations to test that they're okay, and then go out to try to buy clothes at the mall. So if you fit that pattern, you're likely to get a call from the credit card company. Not long ago, the Federal Aviation Authority announced that it had started up a partnership with two companies called Accenture and HNC to use this same technology to create profiles of potential terrorists. And indeed, Brett Ogilvie of Accenture told Business Week that their system will ask if you've made international phone calls to Afghanistan, taken flying lessons, or purchased 1,000 pounds of fertilizer. And based on this information, personally identifiable phone calls and credit card information, the system will try to create a profile of potential terrorists to see whether you look like the terrorists of September 11th. And if you do, for example, if you're a retired businessman who took flight lessons in Florida, you might set off an alert. There'll be yellow alerts for intermediate questioning and red alerts for more intrusive questioning. And based on this technology, the FAA hopes to be able to nip terrorism in the bud.
In order for this technology to work, there's a lot of databases that would have to be interconnected so that so that the FAA could tap into all of these and get the information that we're seeking about potential terrorists. What would it take to connect those databases?
Well, this is absolutely right. The first thing it would take is a relaxation of our privacy laws, because indeed several federal laws restrict the amount of personally identifiable phone information and credit card information that can be released to the government except as part of a specific investigation. It's hard to tell from this system exactly what information the government proposes to include in the database. And indeed, when I called up Accenture and asked them, they said that national security prevented them from divulging what the factors are. I tried to explain that I wasn't interested in what the profiling algorithm was, which would allow perhaps a potential terrorist to beat the system, but only wanted to know if they were proposing to include in the database information that's currently restricted by law, but they stuck to their script and refused to say.
Is there any division among civil liberties activists about whether this kind of trade-off is worth it to help stop terrorism, or about whether this type of centralized database is going too far in infringing on civil liberties?
There is indeed. There's a very lively and interesting debate. The first question that's raised by these profiling technologies is the simple one of whether or not they work. And there seems to be a consensus among the civil liberties community, at least, that this particular profiling technology is unlikely to identify potential terrorists, mostly because the sample of known terrorists is so small. We're really talking about profiling 19 terrorists of September 11th out of 300 million people. You're looking for a needle in a haystack, one civil libertarian described to me, but the shape and color of the needle keep changing. And indeed, statistically, when you've got a very small sample that you're trying to profile, it appears very difficult to create a reliable algorithm. So the first objection of civil libertarians is skepticism about whether or not this particular technology is likely to be effective. A more substantive concern has to do with the dangers of centralizing information in a single database to begin with. And indeed, this was the galvanizing cry of civil libertarians during the last great debate over privacy in the 1970s, and when President Nixon did propose to survey Vietnam protesters, and when the government in the late 1960s proposed a single national database that would unite information from the CIA and from the Labor Department and from a whole series of federal departments. Vance Packard, the great sociologist, wrote a celebrated article for the New York Times Magazine, which became his great book, The Naked Society, in which he warned of the dangers of a centralized database, which would give great power to the government to track, classify, and discriminate among American citizens. So it was really a fear of that centralization that led to the passage of the Privacy Act of 1974 that forbids government from lightly sharing information without good reason. And it's partly for that reason that information is shared in a lot of different places. So civil libertarians are very concerned about the danger of centralization.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article, Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article, Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's about new technologies and databases being developed to help identify and track terrorists, how the CIA is funding some of these efforts, and why civil libertarians are concerned. Let's look more at what's being done to create new databanks and to centralize databanks in the hopes that it would help find and track terrorists. Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, wants to consolidate state and federal databases into a single database. And apparently that's, I guess, what Oracle does is create databases, or at least one of the things that Oracle does.
They do indeed. They're the world's largest database manufacturer. As Ellison described to me, your profiles on Amazon are kept in an Oracle database. Your Yahoo profile is in an Oracle database. Your airline tickets and all sorts of information about you is stored in Oracle databases. And Oracle itself learned about the virtues of centralizing databases about 7 years ago in 1995, when Ellison said that he realized that his company was suffering great inefficiencies because different information was stored in different databases. So the German office couldn't talk to the French office, and prices varied across the globe. Ellison says that by centralizing Oracle's own databases on the internet and making them accessible in one place, the company saved $1 billion a year and found it easier to track and monitor and discriminate among its customers. And he says that the U.S. government would enjoy similar efficiencies if it centralized all of its disparate databases in one place. He complains that the problem after September 11th was that there were too many databases sprinkled out over different places. So the authorities at the INS didn't know that Mohammed Atta had a warrant out for his arrest in Florida. Ellison has offered to donate the software for a single integrated database to the government for free of charge, although he says that upgrades and maintenance wouldn't be free. And he stresses that this would make it easier for the government to share information about terrorists and would also create more reliable profiles. He's suggested the adoption of a digital identification card, which would be optional for citizens but mandatory for aliens. And he wants to collect a biometric, a fingerprint or an iris scan, and store it in a centralized database, which would be linked to the card. And this would make it possible both to make sure that people really are who they say they are at important checkpoints like airports and the border, and also to run background checks to find out whether there's something seriously wrong in their past. So we could find out whether there are outstanding warrants for their arrests. If someone is a deadbeat dad, they might be stopped at the airport. And Ellison says that this would be a very effective use of technology for fighting terrorism.
Do civil libertarians have any specific concerns about that biological identification, either scanning the iris or using a fingerprint?
They do indeed. Civil libertarians recognize that different designs for biometric technology pose different threats to privacy. So Larry Lessig of Stanford explained to me that the most intrusive architecture for an identification system would be the centralized storage of a fingerprint, because this would make it possible for the government to do what's called one-to-many matches. In other words, you could go to a protest scene, for example, dust for fingerprints, plug the fingerprints into the central nationalized database, and figure out everyone who was at the scene. Or you could do the same if you were in a restaurant, dust on a glass and see if someone is having an adulterous affair. Civil libertarians say that it's possible to design an identification system that would be less intrusive. If the fingerprint is stored on the card itself, for example, this would make possible a one-to-one match, confirming that I am who I say I am, rather than showing that I'm actually Jeff Rosen. And this would make it more difficult to engage in the kind of identification of strangers that civil libertarians are concerned about.
I want to ask you about another database security system that Oracle is working on, and this is a system designed to identify early on outbreaks of suspicious diseases and to provide early warning signals for biological warfare attacks. Would you describe the system that Oracle's developing?
It's a very interesting system. It's called the Lightweight Epidemiology Advanced Detection and Emergency Response System, which stands for LEADERS. And this is designed to collect healthcare information from emergency rooms across the country and to look for suspicious patterns. So at 9:20 a.m. on September 11th, the Oracle head of the healthcare consulting unit got a call from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, which feared that the attack on the towers might be followed by a biological attack. He worked for 10 hours and he input all of the information about hospital beds in New York State into this system. He pulled up a screen, which could be pulled up in Atlanta, which has mapped every underground pipe, sewer, and water line in the city with 7,500 digital photographs. It's an extremely detailed architectural map. And using this system, this allows hospitals to report incidents of suspicious diseases like anthrax and Ebola in advance. They can send out email alerts to law enforcement authorities, or voicemail can go out automatically. And by collecting this data and engaging in syndromic surveillance, as it's called, it's an effort to look for unusual syndromes, Oracle hopes to be able to find early evidence of a biological attack and to get some help.
Is this system in use already?
My sense is that at the Twin Towers, it was not, because by the time the system was up and running, they found to their distress that there were almost no casualties. It was all fatalities. So, and thankfully, there was no biological attack. But the system is indeed at use in large public events such as presidential inaugurations, and I think also at the Super Bowl. So it has been deployed in several circumstances already, and they're hoping to expand its use so that, as Oracle said, every hospital, every clinic, every lab in the country is going to have to participate. This will be a bioterrorism shield.
Any civil liberties questions about this database?
Well, there could be, of course, if the information were personally identifiable. We can easily imagine the dangers of a centralized genetic database in which the government could get personally identifiable information about our genetic predispositions and use that either to deny us insurance or to make other sorts of predictions. I should stress that the Oracle database is designed not to be personally identifiable. This is syndromic. It doesn't have my name on it. And I think, as best as I understand the architecture, the fear that this information might be linked back to individual patients right now is unfounded. But there obviously could be dangers. And this distinction between a broad syndromic surveillance in which patterns are detected in ways that are not personally identifiable, and by contrast, a personally identifiable surveillance in which information can be linked to particular individuals, is the main distinction that civil libertarians insist on when they evaluate these consolidated systems. It's much less distressing to look for large patterns of behavior than it is to try to pin behavior on individual people. Another example of syndromic surveillance that Oracle is experimenting with is the use of similar technology to detect patterns of crime in the city of Chicago. It turns out that there's some logic to crime outbreaks, that on certain days with certain weather patterns and certain sporting events, you can predict with relative precision that there'll be outbreaks of crime in particular aspects of the city. So using this Oracle technology, the city of Chicago has dispatched more police officers to particular parts of the city when the technology suggests that there are likely to be outbreaks. And like the leaders' epidemiology technology, this is not personally identifiable. It's not like they're predicting that a particular person is going to commit a particular crime. And the City of Chicago Police Department says they've been happy with the results of this system.
My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article about new technologies being developed to track terrorists will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeffrey Rosen. His article about new technologies and databases being developed to help identify terrorists, how the CIA is funding some of these efforts, and why civil libertarians are concerned will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Now, we started our conversation talking about how the CIA started a venture capital company to invest in Silicon Valley companies that might help create technologies to help identify terrorists. Has that CIA-backed venture capital company, InQtel, invested in any of the database projects that we've been talking about?
The CIA has invested in a series of companies that engage in profiling that is similar to the technologies we've been talking about. And I can tell you about some of them because I talked to them as well. One of them, for example, is a company called IntelliSeek, which has what might be described as a search engine on steroids. It's a kind of Google that can even get more than Google can do because it engages in searches of the invisible web, information which is not archived. But this technology instead goes to the individual search engines themselves and engages in a deeper kind of search. IntelliSeek, with the help of InQtel, is hoping to dispatch its technology at airports so that when you check in, you'd be essentially Googled or IntelliSeeked, and you'd plug in your name, and both the chat that you might have engaged in and also any other references to you on the web would come up. Other kinds of search technologies that IntelliSeek has invested in involve the use of geographic maps. There's a company called Metacarta, started up by a MIT graduate student, which, again, can do a kind of Google search that is linked to a three-dimensional map of the area. So I can put in Terry Gross and find on a map of the United States any web pages that might be associated with Terry Gross in a particular area. a final series of technologies involves not only data mining, but also knowledge management. And the goal of these technologies is to solve what InQtel and the technologists call the Tower of Babel problem. How is it possible that we have all of this open source information available on the web, but it's very difficult to make head or tails of it or to organize it into ways that can be useful for intelligence? So, for example, technologies that had been used to organize resumes so that companies didn't have to read through all of them by hand are now being deployed to organize information on the web in scores of different languages and to monitor chat rooms to see whether an Osama bin Laden chat room has unusual updates. Mohamine and other companies like it are able to scan chat rooms in many languages and to find out what people are saying about the United States government and use this to create usable intelligence. So all of these are different applications of business intelligence technologies in the national intelligence sphere designed to solve the Tower of Babel problem. And based on the CIA's increasing conviction that the most useful intelligence is open source intelligence, you don't always need spies. You can just go onto the net. But the problem is that there's so much information on the net that we need technologies to organize it and make it intelligible.
So, Jeffrey, who will decide what the limitations are on access to data in these databases? You've got the people working on the technology who want to connect databases. You've got the government who seems to want to connect databases, too, and a lot of civil libertarians who object to it. How will this be resolved?
This is a very troubling question, because when I asked it to the technologist, they would say repeatedly, "We just build the machines. It's up to other people, the customers or the politicians, to decide how they should be used." They said, "Go talk to the politicians." Then when I went to talk to the politicians, I talked to Maria Cantwell, who's the most technologically savvy member of the Senate. She complains that she can use her spittoon on the Senate floor, but she can't use a BlackBerry wireless communicator. And she was concerned about the fact that the politicians feel that the technology is so unfamiliar that they are reluctant to regulate it. And she said they really are not very technologically savvy. She explains to them, "You're going to be able to go into your car and say, 'Take me to the nearest Starbucks.'" And they say, "Well, that's great." And then she says, "Well, but there'll be a record that where you were in 2 in the morning in a database." And they become more recalcitrant. So I'm concerned, as she was concerned, that the technologists are not eager to regulate themselves, that the politicians are too afraid of the technology to regulate it, which leaves the courts. And Lawrence Lessig of Stanford was pessimistic on this score. He said there's no court that will stand up for heightened review for privacy. We almost need some kind of privacy commission similar to the Environmental Protection Commission, said Lessig, that would evaluate the effect of a particular database on privacy. But given our current legal strictures, he feared that that would not be done by judges. So all this suggests that there's a big challenge ahead, which is to try to recreate in this new age of databases the checks and balances that we took for granted under our 18th and 19th and 20th century constitution. And it's going to be important that each of these groups, the technologists, the politicians, and the courts, do their part in reconstructing these checks and balances.
You visited several of the companies that are developing this software to help track terrorists. What was the security like at the companies that you visited? Since they specialize in security, they must have pretty good security in their companies.
That's a wonderful question. Actually, IntelliSeq, it was pretty low tech. It's a building across the way in Roslyn, Virginia, and there was this nice security guard downstairs who asked me for an ID, and I actually didn't have one, so I showed my plastic gym card and just went right up. It was one of these pro forma things. But once you get up to their office, there's a very cool Star Wars process where you type in your name and get a name badge with a barcode, and you have to turn it in when you leave. That was impressively high tech. The best one of all was at Oracle Corporation, which has a very elaborate ID card which can track where you are in the buildings at all times. But even at Oracle, you know, human discretion will always trump. It's impossible to get a parking space at Oracle. You have to look around for about 30 minutes, and even though the company is the leader in tracking and predicting consumer behavior, it can't quite find enough parking spaces for its employees. But I went in and talked to the nice security guard, and he said, "Okay, I know you, no problem. I could have the illegal spot." And there was a lot of that sort of informal interaction, whereas people who were actually known and had forgotten their ID cards were waved through. So this goal of completely technological tracking may be a little bit overstated.
Well, Jeffrey Rosen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen's article, The Silicon Valley's Spy Game, will be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Rosen is an associate professor at George Washington University Law School. His book, The Unwanted Gaze, The Destruction of Privacy in America, has just been published in paperback.